So we're going to be hearing Uncle Steve tonight and looking at the subject of Gideon. Uncle Steve's asked that we read from Judges chapter 6. So that chapter then serves as introduction to our consideration around Gideon. And I can see on the overhead, exhausted, but still in pursuit. Thank you, Uncle Steve.
Well, good evening, everybody. We all, I think, know the story of Gideon. You've probably learnt it in Sunday school. You might have even had a Sunday school play, or some way the story is familiar. It's pretty dramatic. You'll know in the next chapter, or the next two chapters, the story keeps going, but I wouldn't have spared Joe reading the whole three chapters. Now, the reason I'm doing it is two reasons. Our theme for this year's Bible class is let us run with endurance. And I think that verse from our section that we're looking at fits very well. But you also may have noticed, if you ever look at your ecclesial plan, that I'm not actually scheduled to speak tonight. It's Kent. But you probably know he's in Hong Kong. So a few weeks back, we sorted that out. I'm doing this. So how many weeks, roughly, would you say I've had to prepare for this talk? Just guess. Yeah, whatever. Well, the answer is 54 years. In 1972, there were three brethren, including me, in Toronto, in Canada, that conducted a study day, which was one of Ron Abel's things to do. And so he was a speaker, me and Ted Hodge. So this is not a new subject for me. Obviously, I had to refresh a few things and check a few more things out, just because I do. So what appeals to me about this man Gideon, and I hope it will appeal to you in the sense that we can all relate to him. He's a very relatable person. And if you pick up on the end of their reading, where he wanted some evidence from God that he would really be the one to defeat the Midianites, and he got it. And then he said, "Oh, look, I'm sorry to ask you again, but can I have another one?" In other words, he's not a particularly confident person. He says, and we'll come to this in a minute, but he says, "You know, why have you picked me? I'm the last person you should be picking." And there's a really profound message in all of that, very much for every one of us today. All right, but there's a lot of other stuff as well. That's, as it says, a picture of the spring. It's not a well, the King James Version uses quaint language, of course, from 400 years ago, and the words mean slightly different things today. It's actually a spring. It comes out of the side of a hill in a little cave. That hill, if you kept on going up, you'd get to the top of the hill. It's called Mount Gilboa. Okay? So if you're standing on Mount Gilboa, not that you can see over the edge, but if you could, down there, oh, that's where the spring of Harod is. And you'll see this at the end. This whole scene, physical geography, is so evocative. But I keep wanting to jump ahead to the good stuff. But let's just go step by step. So we have three chapters all about Gideon. He's the fifth of 12 judges in this book. So, you know, more or less in the middle of the period of the judges. Joshua's died at 110. Then there were the elders that outlived Joshua in chapter 2. And so we're now moved into the middle of the, roughly the middle of the period of the judges. And in Acts 13, interestingly, it's there, not in the Old Testament. But there, the Apostle Paul says that God gave them judges for about 450 years until Samuel the prophet. Now, I don't know if anyone here is interested in chronology. I am. But if you've never, if you think, well, I must look into that, good luck. But I have recently purchased what to me is the definitive book on the chronology of the whole of the Bible. It's mind-boggling. So if you really want to get into it, let me know. I'll lend you the book, or you can buy your own, like I did. Okay, we've read that Gideon was the son of Joash, the Abiezrite. Probably means nothing to you. Well, who's this Abiezer? Well, he was the grandson of Manasseh. Okay, we also know, you might have noticed, he's from the tribe of Manasseh. Oh, that all makes sense. That fits. And he lived in a town called Ophrah. Now, it's fairly easy in Israel to find physical features like a river or a mountain or a plain or a valley. It's not so easy to find a town, because they've been demolished 100 times over. Names have changed over the centuries, millennia, and there's no great certainty as to exactly where Ophrah was. I'll show you a map with it on there. It doesn't matter much, but for some of you may like this sort of detail. Whatever else you might think about Gideon, he's listed in Hebrews 11. So that's our platform, if you like. He's in Hebrews 11, he's named. So if you look about the middle of the map, you'll see Ophrah marked there. There's a modern town there called Afula. Sort of similar sounding name. But what is clear is the Jezreel Valley, Mount Gilboa, the Spring of Harod, the Harod Valley, Hill of Moreh, Mount Tabor. There's no argument about where they are. So we know exactly where all of this is going to happen. That part is easy. So when we look at verse 1, it says that Israel did evil in the sight of God. And that's like a refrain all the way through the book of Judges. Every few chapters, Israel did evil again in the sight of God, and so they got some enemy come and give them a lot of grief. They cried out to God. God saved them. A few years later, they did evil again. It's just a shocking story in that way. But this, we've just read in this chapter, there is a remarkable salvation. But they were delivered into the hand of Midian for 7 years. It wasn't just as if, oh, the Midianites moved in and they beat them and sent them away. They stayed for 7 years. And we also read that the whole land became impoverished, which we'll see in a moment. They didn't just come and sort of live in the town next door. They came and wiped out everything. They stole everything. It was a terrible time for Israel. Now, who are the Midianites? Well, Midian was a son of Abraham by Keturah. Moses fled there when he killed the man in Egypt, and it got reported, and so he had to get out. And that's where he went, because it's sort of a distant family connection. Moses even married a Midianite woman, so pretty close. The Midianites, though, and the Moabites later on hired Balaam to curse Israel. Ah, so the Midianites aren't exactly the nice guys that we could have suspected. But the Midianites were vanquished by Israel, and Balaam, a little bit later, was slain. Now, there's where Midian is. This is Saudi Arabia today. at the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba, and off the map on that side is another gulf called the Gulf of Suez. It takes you up to Cairo. So this is well south of Israel, okay? The Midianites were there when Moses left Egypt, which is on the edge of the screen. He had to cross the whole of the Sinai Desert, cross the Gulf of Aqaba to get into Midian. He didn't just go a few miles out into the desert. He went way, way, way out of that whole area that Egypt controlled. So Midian, that's where Midian is, and they've all moved, the army has moved up into Israel and attacked Israel and created havoc. Now, we noticed that. I won't go through word by word just because we don't have time. But in those early verses 3 to 6, you'll see that whenever they grew a crop, Midianites came in and took the crop. Whenever they bred a few animals, the Midianites came in and took all the animals. They were really in dire straits, terrible poverty. That's really important for something that comes up later. So they cried to God for help, and cutting out a few details again just to keep focused a bit. In verse 11, an angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which is in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. Okay, need to unpack that a bit. In verse 13, when he talks to the angel, he calls him in Hebrew Adonai. He doesn't know that it's an angel. He's not, maybe thought it's possible, but he didn't know. So he addressed him as my Lord, Adonai. And he came, as we just read, and met him under a tree. Now the King James says oak, the New King James says terebinth. The experts suggest that it's actually a pistachio tree, not the ones we get our nuts from, but an ancient variety. And that's a picture of one in the Middle East today, just give you some idea of what sort of tree it was. It's not a massive oak tree that you might think of as being 500 years old or something, just a regular medium-sized tree. Now, that's probably a reasonable guess as to the picture that we've got here. The wine press, what's called a wine press, it's not actually a press at all. It's a hollowed out section in a rock. You see them all over Israel when you go and look at ancient sites. They trample the grapes with their feet, and the juice runs down a little channel into another depression where they collect it. So it's all quite open. And it's, without going into detail, if it was an industrial scale winery, there would be bits of equipment to crush the grapes. This place, and the same with the wheat, you know, there were large scale methods of breaking down the grains of wheat. But here, Gideon's got a small quantity of wheat that they somehow managed to collect without the Midianites getting it. And he's just got a wooden flail, just, you know, basically crushing a few bits of wheat, looking around thinking, I hope the Midianites don't catch me. And this, apparently a man, maybe an angel, but anyway, comes to him and says, what does he say to him? Gideon, you mighty man of valor. Does that look like a mighty man of valor? No. So that's the first part of the unfolding of this quite interesting story, I think. Okay, I've jumped ahead a little bit. He's called a mighty man of valor and hiding. Normally you'd say a mighty man of valor is a big, tough guy out in front of everybody, not this one. And he says, well, you know, you've got to be kidding, sir, telling me that I'm going to save Israel. I'm the weakest clan in the whole of my tribe. My father's house, nothing. I'm the least in the family. And that's a lie. Both of those things are lies. It was the strongest clan, and he was the eldest in the family. But what we're getting here is he's not at all sure about himself. And do you ever have a moment like that? You might even find a lot of your life's like that. I don't know. We don't normally confess those sort of things. Well, you've jumped ahead for me. Thank you. He gets a mention a bit later. So we have here God choosing a person who of himself thought he was worth nothing. That's one of our key messages tonight. If we go back to chapter 5, we're not going to do this now. His family was very distinguished. They were rulers. They weren't a weak clan of nobodies. In chapter 8, it describes his brothers as resembling the son of a king. They were very prominent people, like Moses, Zacharias, and you could probably come up with a few others, who thought God had made a mistake. God, what are you thinking? Calling me to do this extraordinary thing? You must be kidding. Well, we wouldn't quote it in those words, I guess. But if you think about how God would react to us ever saying that, I hope we will think twice before that thought ever crosses our mind. Anyway, as we alluded to earlier, he says, show me a sign. He's not confident. It's not enough for this angel to say, there's your offering gone up in smoke. That proves I'm an angel. And therefore, everything I've told you must be true. Therefore, Gideon, you know, pull your socks up. Let's go. He goes, I don't know about that. And he does it over and over again. First of all, he gets the sign of the fire from the rock consuming his offering. He gets, we read this too, the dew on the fleece only. Then he gets the dew on the ground only. And he gets a fourth one. He overhears the Midianites' dream 4 times. And finally he goes, okay, maybe God can actually do this with me. So I'll give it a go. 4 times, not once. And, you know, we might think of sometimes God's like, okay, I've given you a sign, now get on with it. And if you said, could I have a second one, he'd go, I've given you one. So you get 2, well, all right, 3, 4. But God does. The generosity and the grace of God is just astounding. Not once does he say, I will, but you're really testing my patience. No, he just keeps on helping him, building him up, strengthening his faith. Now, this verse is really the other title of tonight, where Jesus says to Paul in 2 Corinthians 13, verse 9, my strength is made perfect in your weakness. There's a profound principle here. God chooses weak people like you and like me. So if you do feel weak, hello, there's no news there. He chooses weak people because that way the glory's got to be his. It's a really important principle for everybody today, not just back in Gideon's day. And there's a similar idea in Isaiah, another verse I really love. God says that he dwells with those who are contrite and humble spirit. All right. He doesn't dwell with the high and mighty. He doesn't dwell with the strong in their own minds, in their own abilities. Okay, we read that he made an offering. Now, I think it's just a gesture of friendship and appreciation. It's not a particular offering, although it's got a lot of similarities to the peace offering and the sin offering and the meal offering. That's a subject that somebody might want to dig into, but we're not going to. So he makes this offering of a young goat. A young goat. Gideon, think about what you're doing. You should have offered him the oldest one, the one that's not far off dying, because if you sacrifice a young goat, you're sacrificing years of income from that animal. But he still did it. Ah, we're getting another insight into Gideon. He gives him some bread, an ephah of flour. Probably got no idea how much is an ephah. 22 litres of flour. 14 kilograms of flour. Where did he get that from? He's been hiding in a wine press with a little bit of wheat, trying to get enough to live on. And he offers this stranger 14 kilograms of flour. It's the equivalent of 10 days' food for one person. Wow, we are really learning something about this man. He may have been unsure about his ability, but wow, what a generous person he was. And bear in mind, we've said it earlier, almost all the animals in the produce have been stolen by the Midianites. So this may have been almost the widow's two mites. It's all he had, maybe. And I can't prove that, and I'm not trying to make a dogmatic comment. But it really does pay sometimes to understand a simple statement like an ephah of flour. Yeah, yeah. He baked a few cookies or, you know, maybe a little bit of bread. No, he made a feast, basically. And part of the food was a burnt offering, but part of it was boiled because there was a broth which you get from boiling. And that went up in flames as well. So it was a damp offering. It wasn't a dry offering. And then he went, uh-oh. This fellow's an angel. And the feeling in those times was, it's as if you've seen God, and if you see God, you're dead. And so this voice came and said, it's all right. Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die. And so he built an altar there in Ophrah, and he called it, the Lord Yahweh is peace. So, just a beautiful picture. The angels disappeared. Well, then he tells Gideon, I want you to do a few things for me. I want you to tear down your father's altar of Baal, cut down the Asherah, which is translated grove in the King James. It's actually a single piece of wood, which I'll explain in a moment. The word Asherah is a female Canaanite goddess. Baal is a male Canaanite god. So you have a male and a female Canaanite god and goddess in the village, in the yard of his dad, and he's told to demolish the whole thing, burn it up and offer a bullock on this, on the altar as an offering. You know, the whole thing, each sort of little turn in the story opens up a whole new picture, doesn't it? And, of course, they, as we read, sort of, well, we know who did that. So he'd obviously had a reputation of some sort, a good one. Because why else would they assume it's Gideon who's done this when they woke up the next morning and saw their altars, their idols and altar all destroyed? So he had a name, a good one. The name Gideon means a hewer, someone who cuts things down. That's his very name's meaning. So they said, right, let's kill Gideon. Now his dad wasn't stupid. So his dad says, oh, let Baal deal with that. If he's really a god, let him deal with Gideon. Where have you heard that later on in the Bible? Elijah, the prophets of Baal. Yeah, if he's real, you know, he'll do something, show himself, prove himself. Of course, never happens. Now, the Midianites, we read earlier in the chapter as well, they were joined by the Amalekites and the people of the east. They're also referred to as Ishmaelites. So there's quite a big crowd of soldiers that have come into the land. And they're on, verse 33, they're on the south side of the hill of Moreh, in the valley of Jezreel. Now, that might not mean much to you. So here's a section you see up on the top left above the word Jezreel Valley. The town, modern town of Aphula, possibly where Ophrah was. Come across a bit, Shunem. Heard of that? The Shunammite, the widow, time of Jesus, the widow of Nain, the hill of Moreh in between the two. Just a bit further over, Endor. Who lived in Endor? The witch. Just hold it there. If you've never been to Israel and really sort of understood what was going on when you were there, every turn it talks to you. The land is talking to you. You know, all these places, somewhere in the Bible jumps into your mind. Anyway, coming down, the town, modern town of Jezreel, but also that's where, which king had his palace there? Ahab. Here's the well of Harod, the spring of Harod, just nearby, Mount Gilboa, and what's called the Harod Valley, Beth Shan, who was taken there when he was killed. Saul died on Mount Gilboa and his body was taken down here. Here's the Jordan River, Megiddo right over the other side. It's just an extraordinary part of the land. And it's the same everywhere, but that's where we're focused. So, at N-E-N or E-I-N is the word for spring. So the spring of Harod, that's where it is. Now the Midianites have moved up from the Jordan Valley and they're camped on the south side of the hill of Moreh. That's the hill of Moreh. So the Jezreel Valley, the Jordan River, just such an evocative part of the land. It's actually been described, the land of Israel, as the fifth gospel, in that the land talks to you, tells you things. So just obviously with a bit of clarity of thought, Gideon's going, well, we need a big army to deal with this problem. So he calls to all the surrounding tribes. They're mentioned there in verse 35. Not the whole of Israel, but just the ones nearby, because that made a lot of sense. They'll get there quickly. Now, if you're around about where the spring of Harod is, at the foot of Mount Gilboa, you saw that on the first slide. So you're looking at the well, as it's called in the King James, and you turn around, there's the hill of Moreh, just across the valley. So there's nothing between you and the Midianites. They're at the foot of that hill, right in the middle of that picture. So they're quite close. And they're the surrounding tribes that were called in. And you can see how they are, in fact, quite close. So God says, you've got too many men. Too many. I don't know if you not realize, we'll see it in a moment, there were 135,000 in the Midianite camp. 135,000. And they got together a few thousand. But God says, there's too many men in your army, too many for me, God says. I don't need that many. And we're told why God says that, because the glory has to be God's. If you had an army of 250,000, double theirs roughly, and wiped them out, well, you'd go, ooh, pretty good, aren't I? Sounds like Israel today, really. They do quite, from a human point of view, rightly boast in their power and their strength. But there's no glory to God. Anyway, by calling all the people, they got 32,000. And as was provided in the law of Moses, if you're afraid to go, you can go home. It's all right. There's no punishment for you. And so 22,000 hightailed it back home. He's left with 10,000 to fight 135,000. God says, no, still got too many. Something's really going on here, isn't it? It's pretty clear. Still too many, God says. So we don't need to go into how. We've read that before, I'm sure. It came down to 300. And God says, with 300, I will save you. I will save you. You're not going to do it. I will. So you're getting the message through all of this? It's a little bit of a repetition. God is really making a strong point here. And so they were selected by a curious method of how did you drink. There's a lot of speculation as to what that meant. It doesn't seem to me to matter. So in verse 14, when Gideon's crept down into the camp and listened through the canvas tent or, you know, whatever it was, hearing these Midianite soldiers talking about the nightmare they've just had. And they said, God has delivered Midian and the whole camp into Gideon's hands. They got it. They got the message of the nightmare. And Gideon's hearing this. Wow. That's got to boost your confidence, doesn't it? And it did. His confidence had reached a point now, as it were, that he could do anything. But remember where he started. And is that like your life? Now, you young children here, relative to me, that is, it may not resonate quite with your youth in the truth, but those of us who are a bit older probably can think of it, some experiences in our lives that, yes, our faith in God has grown, become stronger from life's experiences. Anyway, it's for you to think about. So the group is divided into three. Well, there's a bit of a kind of, well, we only had 300 to start with. Now we're splitting up into three groups of 100. Okay. And we have this wonderful statement in 1 Samuel 14 that nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. The number of resources is totally irrelevant to God because he's got the lot anyway. Our perspective on life is, well, you know, we haven't got enough members to do this project, or we haven't got enough funds to do that project. That's human thinking. That's all. The message we get from people like the Gideon is that resources aren't the problem. It's your willingness, your desire, your motivation. That's what's needed. Your faith is what's needed. So these 300 are trying to somehow surround 135,000 soldiers in a camp. And so that's somehow how it works. I mean, they may have moved around more than shown here, but that's what we're told. They went from the Harod Spring in three groups, surrounded the Midianites, and you know the story. They had clay jars with a burning torch inside it, and they smashed them, and there's flames everywhere, and the Midianites panicked, and they slaughtered each other and then ran off down back the way they came. And we read, and it's a very good verse to look at carefully here, verse 21 of chapter 7. Every man stood in his place all around the camp. And you might have, if you didn't know the story, might have thought, well, the first thing they're going to do is whip out their swords and go around and start killing all these Midianites, even though the numbers are ridiculous. There's no way we're going to win this battle, but... Well, no, they just stood there holding the torch. That's it. Didn't do anything else because the Midianites killed each other in panic because they thought there must be an army of twice their numbers surrounding them. And they'd had nightmare and, you know, gossip and rumour and who knows what went around the camp, all managed and arranged by God. And we read in Ezekiel and Haggai and Zechariah, the same thing will happen when Gog's army invades Israel in the last days. Every man's sword will be against his neighbour. That's one of the ways God works, and he's going to do it again. Now, I'll actually jump to the map. So they've gone across to the Jordan River. They're running for their lives down the Jordan Valley. Gideon sends a message to his friends down in Ephraim and said, quick, get across to the Jordan and block their escape. And so they hold the ford in the river. Not a car, that's where you can walk in shallow water. They stop the Midianites, so they ran off into the hills up here. And eventually got to this place called Karkor, and that's where they met their end. There's more detail, but we're not going down there. Now, there are two men in the Midianite camp, princes they're called, named Oreb and Zeb. They were captured and killed. Try and remember those two names, Oreb and Zeb. Now here's the verse which I had on the first slide. Let's sort of have a look at it. In chapter 8, verse 4, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men, so he hasn't lost one of them, who were with him, crossed over, exhausted, but still in pursuit. The King James says, faint, yet pursuing. So they've been... going flat out all the way from where they surrounded the Midianites at the top there, all the way down the Jordan Valley and across to Karkor eventually. And they're worn out. And there's another side story again we're not looking at. They went over to the people of Succoth and Peniel and said, come on, give us some food. And they went, nah. And they got their just desserts a bit later. Okay. They went all the way down to Karkor, so they've been running with their armour and equipment 80 to 90 kilometres. No wonder they're worn out. But they kept going, even without the help of the people in those two towns. Reminded me of the verse in 2 Timothy 2. Soldiers have to endure hardship, and we're all soldiers for Jesus. Now, all of that, the whole of that story, is an example of what happens to all the enemies of God's people throughout history and into the future. That's what ultimately happens to all the enemies of God's people. Remember those two names? Psalm 83. Make their nobles of the nations like Oreb and Zeb. That is, off with their heads. And their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession. And of course the Midianites did exactly that. And the psalm is saying, well, the last time somebody tried to do that, they came to an end very quickly. The same thing will happen every time people try to wipe out the nation of Israel. And it will happen again. In Isaiah 9, it talks about, as in the day of Midian. This is the day of Midian, when Midian got its comeuppance, as the old saying. They got what they deserved for daring to try and wipe out Israel. And again in Isaiah 10, the Lord of hosts will stir up a scourge for the Assyrian, like the slaughter of Midian, should be of Midian at the rock of Oreb. So this episode is picked up three times in those places in the Old Testament as a really good example of how God will always protect his people. They may suffer like they did here for 7 years, but God will always rescue them. They will never be wiped out. So after all that, they thought, wow, this guy Gideon's pretty good. So we'll make him our king. And he goes, no, not going to happen. I am not going to be your king. The Lord shall rule over you. Fantastic. He saw it. He got the message. Sadly, they didn't. But he had the right answer, didn't he? Whatever you do, whatever we do collectively or individually, it's all very nice when someone does something, you know, some of you might even say, that was a good talk, and thank me. But ultimately, who are you thanking? God. That's everything you do, everything I do. Ultimately, we should be thanking God for that person. You might well thank them as well. They might have put in a lot of effort and whatever. But ultimately, it's the Lord's got to rule. He's the one who had the victory. We saw that, didn't we? A few slides back. God says, I don't need this many people for this victory. I will have the victory, says God. I will save you, says God. It's a powerful lesson. Well, not entirely right here, Gideon. He said, oh, collect all your gold, the earrings you've got off all these funny people that tried to wipe us out. We'll make an ephod. And so if, I'm not going to be king, but I'm going to have this fancy thing to put around me like a breastplate. And so everyone say, oh, there's Gideon. Whoa, great Gideon. So he didn't do the right thing there. Every faithful servant of God has at least one weakness. You might think about yourself and go, I've got more than one. I've got, But what did we say earlier? What did Jesus say to Paul? I chose you because you're weak. We've got to deal with our weaknesses, sure. But don't panic. God works with weak people. Now, I've really finished, but I can't resist telling you a bit more about geography. This is a timeline from this guy's book that I've alluded to earlier, the chronology of from Abraham to Paul. And I purchased it online recently. So Gideon's around about that period of 1172 to 1133 BC. And so you can see in purple there the other judges and other people that follow. We come down to the bottom where Saul is. So there's a gap of about 160 years later. Saul appears on the scene. Where does Paul appear? On Mount Gilboa, a stone's throw from the spring of Harod. So here's Saul on Mount Gilboa with all the Philistines down there and going, oh, what'll I do? I know, I'll go and find a witch. He goes down the hill, crosses the Harod Valley, goes around the other side of the hill of Moreh to the little town of Endor and sees a witch and walks all the way back again to Mount Gilboa. He's walked past within a very short distance, where Gideon had this unbelievable victory over 135,000 Midianites and others. When he walks around the other side of the hill of Moreh, so let's just say this chair is the hill of Moreh, so he gets around here and there's Endor. What's the hill over here? Mount Tabor. Deborah and Barak had a phenomenal victory there. He's walked past two places 100 or so, 200 years earlier, where amazing victories had been wrought by God through his servants. And he went and saw a witch. So this is a fantastic photo, which in black I've shown you roughly where the spring of Harod is, where the Midianites were camped, but in white there are all the descriptions of where Saul and his army was. And Saul and his sons were killed on Mount Gilboa, their bodies taken off down to Beth Shean, which I mentioned earlier. There's Mount Tabor in the far distance. The Witch of Endor, Hill of Moreh, Philistine camp, almost in the same place as the Midianites, and so on. So one of the lessons from this for Saul rather than Gideon is just think about what's happened here before you came along. And my message to all of us on that principle: learn from the lessons of the past, including in our own lives. Now, let's look at that verse just to finish. Hebrews 12, Hebrews 12 is a phenomenal chapter. It's not only where we get our theme for the Bible class, verse 1, But Josh in his exhort connected us with this chapter. Terrific. So let's look at verse 11. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. That word trained in Greek is where we get the word gymnasium. Life is like a gym. I go to a gym once a week, Di goes twice a week because we're old and we're going to try to keep these old bodies going a bit longer. Doesn't help the brain, but that's another problem. The gym is where you're trained, isn't it? Where you try to improve the condition of your body. The apostle here is using that word to say that your life experiences sometimes are really painful. Another word for chastening is discipline. That's a big subject we haven't time to talk about tonight either. But in 1 Corinthians 11, bread and wine chapter, keep reading on, the Lord, and that's the Lord Jesus, is disciplining us all the time. Why? To improve our condition, to make us better able to cope with whatever comes in life. And that after you've lived as long as me and been baptized 60 years, you can look back and go, wow, I see God worked in my life there and there and there and there, just like Gideon could. Four times he got these amazing little signs, big signs, miracles in a way, to give him that confidence. And that's what life gives us. And it gives us those encouragements because we're weak. And we will not be strong in our own strength, only in the Lord's strength.